Benny Grissel and Vaughan Cupido are stuck doing routine police work in Stellenbosch, a quiet university town far removed from their past with the elite Hawks. But when a student turns up dead on a mountain trail, they are thrust into a tangled investigation that becomes increasingly complex and sinister, hinting at corruption reaching the highest levels of government and law enforcement. Leo, the thrilling new novel by Dion Meyer, is bound to keep you gripped to every page. In this episode of PageCast, Dion is in conversation with true crime podcaster Nicole Engelbrecht. Enjoy.
Hello, PageCast listeners. Thank you to Jonathan Ball Publishers for inviting me back onto the podcast. I am Nicole Engelbrecht, a true crime podcaster and author. And today I have the immense privilege of chatting with one of the most successful writers in South African history, a man whose work has been translated into 27 languages, published in more than 40 countries. If crime fiction is an addiction, Dion Meyer is the head of the manufacturing and distribution cartel.
Nicole, I was worried you were going to say Dion Meyer is the disease, but thank you very much for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. So the focus of today's interview, of course, is Leo, your most recent Benny Grissel offering. And as I was prepping for this interview, I usually listen to other interviews that authors and people I'm speaking with have done. And you come across as quite humble and unaffected by your immense success. So I thought that I would try and make you a little bit uncomfortable. To begin with one of the quotes that I spotted on the back of Leo, which is, "The Mail on Sunday says that you are one of the best crime writers on the planet." What do those words do to your brain when you hear them?
Absolutely nothing, because you know, when you sit in front of the computer and you have to write a new novel, or you're struggling with one that you're writing, that does not make any difference. I think writing as such keeps one humble, because it's a hard thing to do. And every new book is a new challenge. And it does not matter who said what about the previous book, either positive or negative. You've got to knuckle down and start afresh and start and try to do better than your previous one. So I'm extremely grateful when people say that. And I'm especially grateful to my publishers. That was the Mail on Sunday in the UK, and for my British publisher, that was a wonderful thing. And because they go to so much trouble to publish and market and sell the books, I'm very grateful for them. But for me, you can't let that go to your head. But I have to tell you a story. I do a stage show with Kuni de Villiers, the singer-songwriter. And we've been doing this now for the last 8 years or so. And every time I had to go onto the stage, Kuni would usually sing a few of his songs and then he'll invite me onto the stage. And then he'll start with the most successful crime author on the planet. And afterwards, every night I would say, "Kuni, that's not true. Don't say that." And then he'll just do it again. So my wife, Marianne, and I would always laugh a little about, you know, best crime writer on the planet. So a few months ago in Stellenbosch, I had to go drop off something in town at one of my friend's offices. And as we were going up the stairs, a lady came down and she stopped and she said, "You Dion Meyer?" I said, "Yes, I am." And she said, "You know, you are the best crime writer in town." And that sort of brought my feet back to the ground. So I'm very happy to be the best crime author in Stellenbosch. I'm also the only one, and I'm quite comfortable with that.
That's fantastic. Something that I noticed about Leo, and of course in your other work as well, is you often use actual events and, of course, fictionalized from South African society and South African history to sort of act as signposts for readers. And I think one of the most difficult jobs of a writer is to create that environment that draws the readers in, to make them part of the story and you sort of get that buy-in. And by you using these fictionalized but events that people can relate to, I think that works really well to do that. Is that a sort of intentional technique, or is it just part of how you tell stories?
It really is just part of how I tell stories. Obviously, if you're going to write a South African crime fiction novel with South African readers as my primary readers, as my first readers when the Afrikaans comes out, if you create a world that is not credible, that is not believable, that is not the South Africa that they know, then you're going to lose credibility and the reader is going to say, no, this is just too far out. So I try to unleash my characters within the real South Africa, although I make sure that I don't use the real names of corrupt politicians, but the texture of the real South Africa is there, and I think that's what readers, South African readers, expect from you. And because of the fact that it is South Africa, you know, crime fiction is all about suspense, and conflict is the mother of suspense. So you're looking for sources of conflict all the time. And the South African society, especially the political environment, is filled with potential sources of conflict. So why not use that? So it's not a very planned move, but it sort of happens as the characters go out into this world that is South Africa.
That makes sense. And of course, you do have readers all over the world in many different countries. I wondered whether when you interact with readers from perhaps America, the UK, some of the other countries that you're published in, what is their experience of your work different to South African readers at all?
I'm sure it will be, because they simply don't know South Africa as well as South Africans do. Although many years ago, when my books were being translated for the first time, I had a moment where I thought, what do I do now? Do I write for this international audience? What do I change? And I eventually decided not to change anything, to continue to do what I've been doing all along, because that's what worked so far. You know, we live in the age of the internet. If people really want to know more, then there's Google to go find out more. I think there are two things that really matter in any novel if you want to make it as universal as possible. And the first thing is the humanity of the characters. If you can create characters that are really human, with all the foibles, with all the fears of real human beings, then that resonates with any society, any cultural group, anywhere in the world. And the other thing is story structure. Story structure really is a universal thing. Whether it's a novel set in Japan or in Canada or in South America, story structure is an age-old universal thing. And if you can stick to those two things, then the rest doesn't really matter.
That's so true. And I think, speaking of locations, often for me, whether it's a true crime story or a fictionalized crime story, often the town in which the crime or the story is centered acts almost as a character itself within the story. And I wondered if you could tell us a bit about, for you, how you see Stellenbosch perhaps as a character, and maybe also introducing Italy as a location in Leo.
Right. Yeah, Marianne and I are both incomers in Stellenbosch. We've only been there for the last 12 or 13 years. And the great thing about being an outsider coming in is that you look at a place just differently. I think more objectively, with more curiosity, and that really helps in the writing process. I don't mean to make Stellenbosch specifically a character in the book, but again, this is the environment in which your characters operate, and they cannot operate and not interact with this environment and have their perspectives. I try with every book and every scene that I write to show Benny or Vaughan's perspective. Vaughan has a very different perspective on Stellenbosch than Benny does, because they come from different backgrounds. Vaughan comes from the Cape Flats, Benny comes from Paro, so they look at it differently. And so I don't try to force my own views, my own ideologies. When I'm in Stellenbosch, I look and I'm always thinking, how would Vaughan or Benny look at this? What would their reaction be? What would their deductions be about this? So, but Stellenbosch is a beautiful and a fascinating place. I think it is probably the most perfect place to set any novel, for that matter, because of the diversity in everything because of the natural beauty, the fact that there are students, that there's a usually vibrant student community. It makes for a very exciting tapestry on which to write your story. As far as Italy is concerned, our oldest daughter married an Italian. They live in the small town that I wrote about in the book called Poggio Nativo. And when our grandson was born, when we knew he was going to be born, they let us know that there was a tiny little apartment in the town wall. It's one of those hilltop Italian villages with a huge thick wall around it. And inside the wall, there was this tiny apartment for sale for next to nothing. I mean, you can't buy a second-hand car in South Africa for that price. So we bought this little apartment and we renovated it, which was a wonderful experience, which I all used in Leo again. And I had one of my characters do the same thing. And for me, one of the great joys of writing is when you fall in love with something like Stellenbosch, like Poggio Nativo in Italy, it's wonderful to share that love, to share that passion. And I think the writing is better if you're really into it, you know, if you really like it. I find the Italian, especially in the Sabine Hills, which is very different from any other area in Italy, the very fascinating village life there and the culture there and the beauty of the surroundings. It's always green, it's lush, very hilly. We keep two bicycles there, and every time we're there for 2 or 3 weeks, I have to replace the brake pads on the bikes because the downhills are so steep that you just overuse the brake pads. So it's a very natural and normal thing to then write about it because I know it, because I love it, I hope that seeps into the story.
Absolutely. I think you very, where Stellenbosch is concerned, I'm not giving away too much about the book, but you talk about a specific type of crime early on in the book, which is quite, some might see as petty crime, as a silly type of crime, if you will. And then further on, you get into the deep and seedy underworld. And I think that, for me at least, speaks to Stellenbosch. It's this dichotomy between the beautiful overlay and the stuff that goes on underneath.
Right,
you know?
Dark underbelly.
Yeah,
you know, and it's also the life of the real-world detectives in Stellenbosch. Mm. They have to do these mundane little cases where someone comes in and complains about their intellectual property being stolen or a cell phone being stolen because they forgot to lock the car or whatever. And then they also have to investigate really very serious murder cases. Mm. And I try to show that variety of cases that the detectives have to investigate.
That definitely came through. And Benny Crystal is, of course, your most loved character by your readers. And I often wonder if when writers use a character throughout a series of books or, many books in a row, whether they end up doing so almost at some point out of necessity rather than choice. And I don't know, I wonder for you whether you've ever felt any pressure from your readers to continue with using Crystal or if you think he's still an evolving character.
Well, I think he is still an evolving character simply because he's gone through so many stages of his life. In the first book, his wife leaves him. In the next book, he gets divorced. And a book or two later, he meets Alexa Barnard that he, in the previous book, asked to marry. And in Leo, there's a wedding date. We're not sure if Benny is going to make it to the church on time. So, you know, I think... having him go through all these stages in his life keeps him fresh and keeps my focus on him and my concentration on where he is and what's happening to him fresh to a certain regard. And that's hugely important. If you write a series, I think the biggest danger is to start doing the same thing over and over again. And that terrifies me. So I always try to challenge myself a little with every book and to have Benny move on to the next stage of his life. The question of pressure from readers, I think there is that. Also the pressure from publishers all over the world because series novels sell better than loose standing novels. Yeah. But I don't feel all that much pressure when I have a book, for instance, Fever or Trackers that I wrote in between Benny books. If I have a story that I really feel passionate about and very strongly, and I think it can make for entertaining reading, then I will talk to, I have a wonderful agent, Isabel Dixon in London, and she's been great at guiding me to make the right decisions. When I wanted to write Fever, she said, let's just do one more Benny book and then we can do Fever. Because, for instance, at that stage, we were on the verge of a breakthrough in the Netherlands. So it was very smart advice. So if I do have a story that's not a Benny and Vaughan story, I will keep it on ice until its time comes. So in that way, I don't feel the pressure or the need. But it's a funny thing, you know, when you... I never thought that I would write a series.
Yeah.
And Benny came along as a minor character in Dead Before Dying, and he sort of sneaked into the book and became a bigger character than I anticipated. And I had real fun writing about him, and I thought if I find the right story, I'll make him a protagonist. And then writing Devil's Peak, which was his first novel as the protagonist, I was again aware of how many creative options he gives me as the writer. And he's really fun to write. He's interesting. The influence that he has through his personality on the stories, I think, make for better storytelling. So then you start, and it's a subtle thing, then you start looking for stories that would go with Benny, that would be a good fit for Benny. And then you start looking at a partner that would be a good fit for Benny, and that's how Vaughan Cupido happened. So it's the, also the pressure that you put on yourself, but also the pleasure that you get from writing about a character that makes him come back again and again.
That's interesting that you say that. I think that's, I've said before too, you know, crime writing is a little bit of a, on the fiction side, is a bit of a hobby. Obviously, I write true crime professionally. And people have often asked me, you know, I've got writer's block. What do I do? And for me, it's always been the characters sort of guide you. The characters will, as strange as it sounds, the characters will tell you where they want to go next if you listen hard enough.
Yeah, and people often misunderstand that. I absolutely agree with that. It's not as if you don't have free will in terms of what the characters do, but you got to, if you listen to them, if you understand them, if you understand their psyche, then they will guide you to where the story should go. And once you get that partnership with the characters, it's a beautiful thing.
Absolutely. And with your work now being, well, over the years adapted to screen, most recently in Devil's Peak and also of course Trackers and other projects, one of the things that I thought was quite interesting was watching predominantly on social media how many of your readers have these diverse reactions to seeing these characters brought to visual life in front of them. And I guess sometimes it matches what they thought and what, you know, sometimes it doesn't. What's that experience been like for you?
That's been fascinating. I've always thought that, you know, we can be 10 people in the room reading the same book and we'll all have a different picture of what Benny looks like. And so many readers sent me emails or on social media messages saying, this is not my Benny. Now, you know, it's impossible to have an actor that is going to be everybody's Benny. I thought the actor was brilliant.
Yeah.
I thought he encapsulated Benny and Benny's soul really, really well. But it's a lesson that you learn very early in your writing career. And if you don't learn it, then you're in for a lot of pain. And that lesson is you can't please everybody all the time. So you've got to make decisions that are right for whatever you're doing, whether it's a book or a TV series. I was not involved in the making of Devil's Peak, but I thought it was a very, very good TV show.
Indeed, absolutely. So going back to what we spoke about, where you weave these currents or just, you know, past South African political and crime events into your books, a sort of theme that I picked up throughout Leo especially was this true justice versus the appearance of justice, and how the public often sees one thing while behind the scenes something very different played out. Is that something that you, as a South African citizen, as a citizen of the world, think about when you read about perhaps organized crime situations or political events?
Yes, it is. You know, all events concerned people, real people. And we have, as human beings, we have such a black and white view of the world. People are either horribly wrong or absolutely right. Yeah. And the reality isn't quite like that. And I love reading books where even the bad guys are human. Yes. And you, if you have a little bit of empathy for them, and Chrissy in Leo is such an example. She's a character that comes from Trackers. Mm-hmm. And even back then, she was not a very honest human being, but you understood why she was as she was, and she was perfect for Leo, so I brought her back. And I hope that I can create within the reader that little bit of unease. I really like this character, I want her to succeed, but what she's doing is morally not quite right. You know, you try and soften that by the source of there's a big heist section in the early part of the book, and what they are about to steal is money that has already been stolen, which sort of makes it okay, but still people can get hurt, people can get killed. So as a reader, I love reading books that makes me think. I did the same thing in Devil's Peak, where Tobela is a vigilante killer because he wants to get after people who hurt children. And there again, I hope to have the reader say, I'm absolutely invested in your journey, but what you're doing is not right. You're going outside law and order. Yeah. What makes it especially relevant in South Africa is that our justice system and our law enforcement systems have not always been up to scratch. And then I think it becomes easier to empathize with someone who's breaking the rules because society isn't helping them to do that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think I've seen that in my true crime journey as well, is coming to terms with the fact that there's not really much that separates us from them in terms of the public from offenders.
Exactly.
You know, we're all just really shades of grey.
Yeah, we all have the potential somewhere inside.
Absolutely. Something else that struck me while I was reading Leo is that an antagonist does not necessarily always have to be a character. And I think with Crystal and Cupido, the ineptitude and the corruption within the SAPS almost becomes, and they're up against that as much as they're up against the criminals.
Absolutely.
You know, so that's almost becomes an antagonist in itself.
Right.
And I wonder, do you think that's a fair reflection of the experience of a South African detective?
Yes, I think it is. But I have to hasten to say that it's not new in crime fiction. Again, talking about sources of conflict, what you try to do is to create sources of conflict within the character. The character is conflicted within, but then also with his immediate environment, which is the police service. And crime fiction, for the last 50, 60 years, cops have been in constant friction with the system, because the system doesn't always work, whether it's in LA, whether it's in London, whether it's in Paris. That's a very normal thing. I think in South Africa the system is perhaps more broken than most first world countries, and it's another great vehicle to ratchet up the suspense. Is not only are they struggling against the evil of the perpetrators, but also they're struggling against the problems within the system.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, your books always have all of these layers and all of these twists and turns, which, as you mentioned earlier, is necessary for the genre. I know writers sort of try to classify themselves as either planners or pantsers. So they're either developing these great outlines before they even put pen to paper, or they are literally flying by the seat of their pants. So where would you put yourself on that sort of continuum?
I'm somewhere in between. I don't write down ideas, and I don't plot on paper, but I plot a lot in my head. I spend a lot of time thinking about the story. The next book that I've just started now, has been in my head constantly now for the past year. And I find that's a much better way for me to work. If you have a really good idea, it'll stick. If you have a bad idea, you'll probably forget it. My agent, Isabel Dixon, often asks me to write a synopsis of the next novel because she's got to sell it to the publishers worldwide. And I absolutely hate that because I feel that once it's written down, I become the prisoner of that. And I want the freedom of discovering the story as I write. I know where I want to start the story. That is, to me, the first big decision is exactly where do you start it. And within crime fiction convention, that's usually two cops standing over a body. But you can't always have that, you know. So I've moved away from that a little bit, but the start must still be quite exciting. And then I have a potential ending in mind, and that potential ending should be exciting enough so that it gives me a direction in which to write. There's a wonderful quote from an American author who says that for him, writing is like driving in a car at night. He knows where he is, and he knows what the destination is, where he's going. But all he can see is what is illuminated by the headlights, which is the next few chapters. And for me, that's more or less how mine works. I think I have more milestones up ahead. I know, you know, not that I know how many chapters, but I know somewhere between where I am and the ending, certain other big turning points must happen. So I write towards the next big turning point, but always with the ending in mind. But doing research and thinking about it, the ending can change. In half of my books, I had a different ending than the one that I started out with. And to me, that's the freedom that I want. I want to keep on exploring. Because what I'm doing is I'm creating entertainment. And if one ending is better entertainment for the reader, is more enthralling, is more satisfactory, then that is where I should go. I'm a slow writer and I'm a slow thinker. So I like to take my time to work this out and to discover the book chapter by chapter.
And I think that would be interesting for readers to know that you've almost gone on this journey once before they go on the journey with you, that you finally put on paper.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing. I often get asked, but who is my audience? Who is the audience that I'm writing for? And the fact of the matter is, I think all writers have an audience of one, and that is the reader inside themselves. It's the only reader you know, is the only reader who can look at what you're writing and make some sort of an assessment of, is this working or not? And all you hope is that the reader inside of you has the kind of taste that is shared by a fair part of the reading population. And that's a recipe that I've stuck to for many years.
That's very true. You mentioned earlier your book Fever. And that's, of course, a dystopian novel set in a post-apocalyptic South Africa. And that made me think about our own experience of that sort of time during the COVID-19 pandemic. And, of course, I want to preface this by saying that I know a lot of people had a really devastating and life-changing experience of that time. I was quite lucky in that it didn't affect me terribly. But as a writer, I remember sitting there and thinking, this is insane that I'm actually getting to have this lived experience of these pandemic conditions where the streets are empty and all of these weird things that we never thought in our lifetime we would ever see. And we had really only ever read about in books before. And us as writers were getting to live through this. You know, I wonder what that time was like for you in your creative process.
Yeah, it was very surreal. COVID happened, I think, 3 or 4 years after Fever was published. And I had forgotten, for instance, that I used a coronavirus in Fever, which was not my cleverness. I consulted with a virologist at Stellenbosch University called Professor Wolfgang Preisser, and I asked him, please give me a virus that can do this sort of damage. And he and a colleague of his proposed a coronavirus. And then when COVID came, I got a call from a French newspaper wanting to do an interview, and they reminded me that I used a a coronavirus. But as you say, going through that, it was really like living in a movie. It was unreal. It was so real. We were talking about that in the car yesterday on our way to Cape Town. It's as if my recollection of it is as if having seen a movie, or it's not real.
I mean, I clearly remember sitting there 2 or 3 days before the lockdown was initially announced, and still saying to my family, "They're not going to do this. You know, don't be silly. How are they going to lock down the whole country?"
Yeah.
And now we know how they locked down the entire country. Yeah. So, despite your international fame and success, and all the languages that your work has been translated into, I was really fascinated to hear you say on another interview I listened to that all of your work is actually initially written in Afrikaans.
Yes.
That's incredible.
Well, it's my mother tongue, you know, and you know how hard writing is. You know how hard it is to create something that hopefully works. And to do that in a second language is going to be even harder. I mean, I struggle writing crime fiction in Afrikaans. When I started, there was no crime fiction, original Afrikaans crime fiction, for quite a number of years, which was interesting in itself. But I had to sort of discover the texture of Afrikaans for crime fiction, because the language of crime fiction is different to that of any other form of fiction. And still, even today, you know, to find that right texture, the feeling of the language, the vernacular, the right words, it's hard enough in Afrikaans. So for me, it would be incredibly difficult to write it in English. I have a wonderful translator who does marvelous work. I work closely with her once she's done to make sure that it is absolutely a mirror image of the Afrikaans. As far as one can, there are certain things that are untranslatable. For instance, Vaughan Cupido speaks in Cape Flats vernacular in Afrikaans, and you can't translate that because people who don't understand Afrikaans, especially Cape Flats Afrikaans, would not be able to understand.
Of course.
But then again, I don't think it matters. I think it's a bonus for Afrikaans readers, but in the greater scheme of things, if a Frenchman or a German or an American reads that, he's got to get a sense of the character, and it doesn't matter if he doesn't get a sense of the vernacular.
That makes sense, absolutely. I just think it's such a great thing for South African culture, with Afrikaans, of course, being a part of South African culture, that has been then taken and translated into so many, you know, that work has gone out almost like a spider web and been enjoyed by so many other cultures and languages.
Well, I'm still thrilled by it every day. We've just come back from a book tour in Germany, and seeing my translated German books on a bookshelf there just thrills me to bits. You know, it's something that I never expected would happen.
Yeah, phenomenal. Sure. I often feel that, you know, when people try and fit books and writing into genres, it makes me feel a little bit stifled. And so I felt it quite liberating to hear you say in another interview that you don't write to a genre formula because you find that limiting, and instead you see your job is to tell stories.
Yeah.
And I wonder, have you ever come up against any sort of resistance, whether from publishers or readers, to that approach, or do you think maybe it's actually contributed to your success?
I don't know if it's contributed, but I know I've never had any resistance. I think the writing process in itself gives you resistance. I wrote a book called Trackers some years ago, in which I consciously decided that I was going to sort of challenge the norms and the typical crime fiction conventions, just to see if one can go outside. And it was the toughest book I ever wrote, because those conventions are there for a reason. And after that, I've happily gone back to the typical crime fiction conventions. I think you can be creative within. If you look at the diversity of crime fiction all over the world, then I think there's enough space within the genre to do all sorts of interesting and satisfying things. So, but I learned that the hard way. But I know I've never experienced any pressure. Eventually, the story is king. The story must work. I never consciously decide my next novel is going to be a crime fiction novel. I just think in terms of this is the next story I want to tell, and I had better make it work.
Incredible. I was wondering about whether you've had any formal writing training, or I know that you've always been a proponent of reading in order to learn the genre. What has that been like for you?
I think reading is probably the best thing that an aspiring author can do. Not in terms of the writing as such, but in terms of storytelling. To absorb the structure to me is the most important part of storytelling. And sometimes I get asked to look at manuscripts from new authors, and the biggest failing or the most common failing is in structure. The writing, I often say that you don't have to write very well. You need to tell a great story, and the publisher will fix the writing, but a publisher can't fix a bad story or bad story structure. I was very fortunate in that I started my working life as a newspaper journalist, where you had to write every day under huge pressure for a daily newspaper, and you had people, my news editor and the subs. Recalling my first 6 months at the newspaper, it was just my news editor had a green ink pen, and it was just a battlefield of green ink on all my contributions. And then you very quickly learn to work with words, how to work with sentences and paragraphs, and also the structure of newspaper stories are very important. And then I got even luckier. I went working in advertising, where I had wonderful mentors who taught me a lot of the finer points of writing, how to choose the best word, how to structure stories, how to keep sentences short, how to let one sentence flow into another, and then create a paragraph and then create another paragraph. So I was very lucky in that I had about, I think, 15 years of working with words every day, of writing every day, mostly under pressure, before I seriously started writing fiction. And that did make a huge difference. But it's not essential. I think if you want to become an author, that is not an essential skill to have. Because when you are going to sit down and write, writing is like any other thing. Repetition is the mother of skill, and the more you do it, the better you will get at it. But still, reading, I think, is a wonderful way to learn the broader aspects of writing, the characterization, the plotting, the story structure. I think that is as important.
Absolutely. Something that really resonated with me that you've said before is how you, in your early 20s, you recall feeling as though you didn't have enough life experience to be writing almost credibly.
Yeah, I attempted a novel in my early sort of mid-20s.
Yeah.
And I did 50, 60 pages and realized it was very, very bad. And I sat back and I thought, but why is this not working? And I realized that, I just don't have enough life experience yet. I haven't gone through enough myself to write certain scenes, to feel certain emotions, to create emotions that were credible within the characters. And that was probably the best thing that had ever happened to me, because had I finished that and submitted it and no publisher would have published it, then, that could have been so crushing to my self-esteem as a writer that I would never have attempted it again.
Yeah.
Even my first published book, when I reread it a few years afterwards, I realized how bad it was, how much I had learned in the process. Yes. But the important thing is to write that first one, learn those lessons, learn the skills. And even if the first one isn't accepted, then go on and write another one. Because the beauty about writing is that it's a lifelong learning experience. You never stop writing. Every new book I write, I learn new things. I make new discoveries in terms of stories and characterization and plotting and tempo and suspense. Just keep going.
Absolutely. I think recently, in at least the last few days around when we're recording this interview, there's been a lot of worldwide talk about what is democracy and what's the value of democracy is. And I know you've mentioned as well, and that really hit home for me, that crime fiction can only, and I guess certainly true crime as well in the nonfiction side, can only be written within a democratic society.
Yes.
That's incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons why there was almost no South African crime fiction created under apartheid.
Yeah.
And if you look at all the countries where there are dictators, crime fiction does not really exist.
Mm.
We need the democracy, and that's the wonderful thing about South Africa, is that we have freedom of speech, we have freedom of the media, and we have democracy.
Mm, absolutely. What is your, when you're not on sort of on tour as you are at the moment, you know, promoting Leo, what does your average day look like in terms of writing? Do you write in the morning?
Yeah, I write in the morning. In the early days when I still had a day job, I got up very early. I could only write between 4 and 7 in the morning, maybe 6:30.
Mm.
And I got used to that time of day because it's quiet, there are no distractions, kids are asleep. But when I started writing full time, it became a little bit later. I now like to sit down at 6 o'clock in the morning, and then I'll rewrite what I did the day before, read and rewrite whatever I did the day before. And then after Marianne and I had breakfast, I will continue writing. The first half of the book, I found it hard to write past lunchtime, because it's a struggle. You know, you're really building the book, you're doing a lot of research. So in the afternoons, I'll often do more research. I'm also involved in a movie and television production company, so I'll do a lot of meetings in the afternoon. Marianne and I love riding mountain bikes, and we started playing paddle. We mostly lose, but we're having a lot of fun. So we also try to get exercise in the afternoon, because there's nothing more unhealthy than sitting down and working. But then the last third of the book, it will possess you. Mm. And then the writing hours start getting longer and longer. And I would say the last quarter, I often write 14, 15 hours a day just to get it done. And that's 7 days a week. It's it really becomes an obsession.
Yeah, I can imagine. And then that incredible relief when it's done.
Tell me about it.
And then the pain of getting the first edit back from the editor.
Yeah, yeah. But that relief is huge. I often jump up and run to Marianne and say, it's done, it's done, it's done. It's a huge relief.
That's incredible. So I guess my closing question is maybe a bit reflective. What do you think that 14-year-old Dion, who took his sort of first completed piece of writing and showed it to his brothers, and his brothers told him he was terrible, what would 14-year-old Dion think about the writer and the man you've become today?
Well, I think he would be totally astounded. You know, I grew up in Klerksdorp in what is today the Northwest Province, in a mining town where there were no writers, where making a living from writing was not something that you even dreamed of. You did not entertain that possibility. If you did get the opportunity to study, you became either a lawyer, a doctor, or a teacher. And I was not smart enough for lawyer or doctor. So I went to university thinking that I would probably become a teacher, and I ended up in journalism. So I think the 14-year-old boy would be totally astounded and say, this can't be true.
That's wonderful. Well, Leo is a phenomenal piece of writing. It's a book that I found myself, I don't get to read fiction as much as I'd like to, but when I was reading it, I actually found myself having almost this internal dialogue with myself about, especially when we got to the end where Benny has this very important appointment he has to meet and that could have life-changing consequences for him. And I actually found myself asking myself, contemplating whether Alexa would be, you know, whether she would accept the fact that he might be late or might not turn up at all. And then I actually had to pull myself back and go, Nicole, these people actually aren't real. And I think that is just the mark of an incredible writer.
You are very kind. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure and privilege. I wish you all the best for your current project, for your future projects. And just know that we will be waiting, absolutely, for the next one.
Thank you, Nicole. The pleasure is all mine.
Thank you. Pagecast listeners, you can purchase Leo at all good bookstores, both online and in person. And it's also available as an audiobook on Audible, which I highly recommend as an incredible listening experience. And it's available as an ebook on Amazon. A huge thank you to Jonathan Bull Publishers for including me in this episode of Pagecast. And until we chat again, keep reading.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Pagecast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.